From KQED in San Francisco, this is the California Report, the statewide news program focusing on the issues, culture, and public affairs of the Golden State.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, Live Search, and Ask.
KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, some of our favorite stories and interviews from the past year, including one about a former gang member desperately trying to leave behind a life of violence.
You know, I want to pull out of my driveway, you know what I mean? Out of my driveway, my own driveway, pull out of it and just go to places, as a family, you know what I mean? And just go do things, go on a little family trips and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And just come back home, go feed the dog.
Also, a profile of the young Venezuelan conductor who's taking Los Angeles by storm, and a conversation with an author who went from atheist to believer and launched a major food pantry in San Francisco.
I didn't want to be a Christian. I didn't want to be a religious nut. I liked my life just fine.
Those stories and more on this year-end edition of the California Report. Our look back at 2007 begins with a story that moved many listeners to write, wanting to help a young man trying to leave behind his life of violence in Los Angeles. Gabriel Hinojas spent almost half his life in a Latino gang. After his last stint in prison, though, he made a big decision. He was going to be a responsible, law-abiding citizen and father. But as L.A. Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, turning a new leaf was easier said than done.
Gabriel Hinojas is running late, but maintains his cool. As the short and stocky Latino casually struts into a laser tattoo removal office, the doctor asks him which tattoo he wants removed first.
Where have you seen the ink on the doc?
The doctor gives him a look that seems to ask, where to start? Black Gothic letters make up the word Florencia across Gabriel's forehead. This name, his former street gang, is also tattooed along the entire front side of his thick neck. This is not a guy you'd want to meet in a dark or even well-lit alley. For Gabriel, these tattoos are reminders of a chaotic and disturbing life. Reminders he wants erased. The doctor points what amounts to a laser pencil towards Gabriel's face.
Ready?
Ready.
Let's get this one all across the forehead out of here.
Oh, wee.
Anytime you want to stop, say the word stop. And we'll stop, otherwise I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah, go ahead, knock it off.
Keep breathing.
Laser pulses as hot as 800 degrees are shot into Gabriel's tattoos, exploding the ink and burning his skin. The pungent smell fills the room.
Three letters to go. It's fading out nice. Yeah. Oh.
Gabriel's abusive, drug-addicted father abandoned him and his mother when he was 14. Soon after, he ran away and joined the Florencia gang in South Central Los Angeles. He bought a gun, he started selling and smoking crack, and he learned how to steal cars. All of this ended one day 6 years ago when he tried to kill his dealer in a drive-by shooting.
Luckily, I didn't hit nobody because I would have been here right now talking to you.
A judge sentenced Gabriel to 2 years. The day he entered prison, Gabriel left at home his pregnant wife Sandra, a stepson, and a daughter. He got out on parole 3 years ago, and he now lives in East L.A. with his family.
Come on, Jonathan.
Gabriel and Sandra, along with their now 4 children, live in this tiny 2-bedroom apartment in a neighborhood patrolled by Latino gangs. In order to resist the temptation of rejoining the gang life, Gabriel took a job with Homeboy Industries, a nonprofit whose goal is to reform gang members. Gabriel does administrative work for Homeboy, as well as counsels teenagers. But living the straight life is challenging. The lack of money, which Gabriel used to resolve by stealing cars or selling drugs, is something he and his wife now struggle with all the time.
Lately, we haven't been shopping because we've been paying bills. It's just hard, you know, it's just hard. It's just responsibility having 4 kids.
It's hard, but it's worth it. Gabriel says prison forced him to evaluate his life and choose between his street family and his real family. He decided it was time he needed to be a responsible husband and father. Now his face lights up as he dreams of a life that many would consider routine.
You know, I want to pull out of my driveway, you know what I mean? Out of my driveway, my own driveway, pull out of it and just go to places, like a suburban or something as a family, you know what I mean? And just go do things, go on a little family trips and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And just come back home, go feed the dog, you know what I mean? Forgot to feed him, you know what I mean? Or, you know what I mean? Stuff like that, you know what I mean? I want that, you know?
But on the path to this new life, he's learning something, that parenting children who up to now haven't had a responsible father in their lives is very difficult. From his living room couch, Gabriel tries to calm down his firstborn son, Junior, who's fighting with his older sister. Junior has a violent temper and bullies other kids. Gabriel and Sandra are worried about his obsession with guns and gangsters. In the past year, Sandra's caught Junior flashing gang signs from her car.
He'll see gangsters out in the street, and he'll throw the F at them, or he'll tell them Florencia. And we're just like, we'll look at each other like, what the hell is he doing, you know?
This might not be so shocking if it weren't for his age. Junior is 4 years old. Sandra is worried about him.
He would see the guns around Gabriel a lot, you know, and then I guess that's what he probably, I want to be like my daddy, you know, and he's, ever since that, he's been, always wants guns. Instead of an ice cream, he wants guns. Instead of chips, guns all the time.
At the mention of this, Gabriel's face darkens and he grows quiet. Four-year-old Junior chimes in.
Because I like guns.
But guns are not good for you, Junior. No, they're not. Why?
Instead of asking why guns are good for him, Junior's five-year-old sister, Leilani, explains to him why they're not.
They could shoot people.
Gabriel silently gets up and walks out of the apartment, resting his arms on the outside balcony. This topic is clearly a sore spot for the young couple. A few minutes later, he comes back in to deal with another one of Junior's tantrums. Gabriel says the only way to calm him down is to sit him in front of his favorite video game. The game is called Driver, and it allows Junior to shoot people on screen.
That's the only way he can stay there. The only way. And Daddy always gives him his way.
I got him.
Gabriel knows his wife hates this game, but he has a hard time saying no to his kids. He doesn't want to be like his parents.
Well, like right now, I give him his way because I never had it. You know, it used to be strict on me, you know? I want to give him the things I never had to, you know what I mean?
Back at the tattoo removal office, a doctor is finishing up the Florencia on Gabriel's forehead. It's now red and puffy, and the tattoo's still there. It'll take 6 more visits over the next couple of years to completely erase it. But as it vanishes, the life that tattoo symbolizes, fears Gabriel, may return. But this time, through his son. And it's going to take more energy than a laser to remove it. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Since that piece aired back in April, Rob has checked back with Gabriel to see how he's doing. The good news is that he's still working at Homeboy Industries in L.A., and he's taken on more responsibility there. The less good news is that his son, Junior, is having lots of problems at school, like beating up kids in his preschool class. The family is working with the school to see if Junior has attention deficit disorder or some other health problem. The sound of morning prayers at St. Gregory's Episcopal Church in San Francisco. Nothing extraordinary about that. But there is something worth noting about the woman leading the service. Just a few years ago, Sarah Miles was an atheist, a left-wing journalist and non-believer who never gave much thought to the role religion might play in her life. Well, all that changed 8 years ago when Miles spontaneously walked into St. Gregory's Church and took communion. That act sparked a religious conversion that led her on a path to founding a church food pantry. The journey is detailed in Miles' book, Take This Bread. When we spoke back in March, I asked her to describe that moment in 1999 when a piece of bread turned her life upside down.
I put the bread in my mouth and I realized two things at the same time. And one was that I was eating a piece of bread. And the other thing that I knew was that God was real and alive and was in my mouth. And the disconnect between those two truths, this was a piece of bread, this was God, this was a piece of bread, this was God. I didn't believe in God. I don't know who the hell God is. I'm eating a piece of bread. Broke me open.
You describe it in the book as the shocking moment of communion. And you describe it as outrageous and terrifying.
It was very scary. I didn't want to be a Christian. I didn't want to be a religious nut. I liked my life just fine. I think a lot of people go to church because they're searching explicitly for something. And I certainly didn't think that I was searching.
This conversion to Christianity, you describe it as terribly inconvenient. What was so inconvenient about it? Was it that it just didn't sync at all with the rest of your life at that moment?
Well, you know, when I went to church for the first time, I knew exactly one person in the city of San Francisco who went to church. I was living in a very secular, intellectual world. I'm a lesbian. I loathed the politics of much of the Christian church. It didn't seem to fit with the identity I'd carved out for myself.
How did the conversion to Christianity, how did that link up with this notion that I have to start a food pantry at our church?
The thing that I loved about Christianity as I stumbled into it was how physical and material it is, how much it's a religion about bodies and eating, pieces of bread, grain and wine. And I felt that I had walked in as a stranger and been fed. And I wanted to make that literal for other people. I wanted to stay at that altar and keep feeding other people.
There is a passage in the book that describes this food pantry, which caught on very quickly. And one of the concerns that the church had was the skeptics felt it would never work. People wouldn't come to it. This is a church that is mostly white, upper middle class folks on Potrero Hill in San Francisco. There is a housing project, as you point out, nearby, but pretty wealthy people in that neighborhood. If you would read a part of the book that kind of describes who was lining up to come to this food pantry.
A long line would form on Fridays in front of the church, beginning hours before we opened. While other volunteers finished unpacking the groceries, I'd go outside and talk with people in the waiting crowd. At least half my conversations were in Spanish. Here was the city I lived in, at last. The pantry wasn't hushed and pious, it was loud and holy. As the whores and cripples, widows and foreigners, and thieves and little children gathered outside, it took on an almost biblical atmosphere. There were a lot of extended Latino families with fussed-over chubby babies wrapped in pink acrylic blankets. There were black grandmothers from the projects nearby and a beautiful deaf woman with her three kids. There were homeless crackheads and street kids and a couple of schizophrenics, a bunch of old Moldavian ladies in headscarves, Russians with gold teeth, chain-smoking Chinese men in jackets. There was a hyper, skinny black man who danced compulsively to the music on his headphones, whirling around on the sidewalk, shouting out, "Love ya! Love ya!" over and over. There was a very sick prostitute and her faithful friend who'd sit on the steps sharing cigarettes. There was Phil, the speed freak, and Michael, the big, scruffy British guy, and Nirmala, the radiantly calm Chilean woman, all three of whom would later become volunteers themselves. Nirmala chatted easily with me. She lived serenely in a single-room occupancy hotel over a bar on disability. "I'm not happy," she told me, "but I'm content. Content is deep."
Sarah Miles reading from her new book, Take This Bread. How did starting the food pantry, your conversion to Christianity, how did it change the way you felt about your community, about this place, San Francisco?
I think before the food pantry, I'd experienced food in that kind of foodie way. Here's the perfect goat cheese. Here's the perfect peach. Let's go down to the ferry building and buy a lovely basket of strawberries for $17. And instead, what I saw was how hungry people are in the city, how difficult it is to get by in the city if you're working, even. And so I began to see the parts of the city that had been left out from the myth.
Fair to describe you as a leftist?
Fair to describe me as a leftist. I still am one.
Yeah. Yeah. So this conversion to Christianity hasn't changed that at all.
Well, yes. I think becoming religious has made me less sure and less absolute about things. You have this idea, I had this idea, that being religious meant you knew all the answers and you knew what you believed. And what I've found is instead it throws things open and involves doubt and makes me appreciate the complexity of things more.
The way you describe it, it's kind of an extension of journalism in a way, that skepticism and seeing things from more than one side.
It is. You know, I think that religion for me is much less about what I believe than about what I'm willing to see. I think the question of if you believe, what are you going to do about it has been central for me.
Sarah Miles is author of Take This Bread, a spiritual memoir about her journey from atheism to Christian activism. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for this year's California Report. As you probably know, we're a production of KQED Public Radio. And if you want to listen back to any of the other stories we broadcast this year or see slideshows of some of the places we visited, it's easy enough. Just go to our website, californiareport.org. Our director is Susie Rocho. Danny Bringer is behind the controls today. We had additional engineering from Seal Muller and Howard Gelman. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our Remembrance of Notable Californians was produced by interns Deidre Crawford and Megan McCarty. The producer is Victoria Malione. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer, with help this week from Kat Snow. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a fun, safe New Year's holiday and that all your wishes come true for 2008. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.